Rivets will meet again tomorrow night at Simmons Field. Major League Baseball, the Brewers lose to Minnesota 5-4. Cubbies beat the Giants 5-3. So the Cubs are now in first place in the NL Central by a game and a half over the Brewers. The White Sox were off. Tonight, the Brewers play again in Minnesota. Cubs play in San Francisco one more time, and the White Sox host Houston. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Tuesday, August the 8th. Lovely day today, sunny and warm. We're heading for a high of 80. Clear and mild tonight, low 58. More of the same tomorrow, sunny and warm. Once again, 80 degrees for Wednesday. Right now, humidity is 81%. A little breeze from the west at 6. 59 degrees as we come up on 8:11. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg, up next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses designed for the working adult. More information at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. One of the distinct pleasures of this line of work is the opportunities that come my way to reconnect with outstanding authors with whom I have enjoyed previous interviews. That's the occasion today as I reconnect with a best-selling novelist by the name of C.J. Box, the author of more than 20 different novels. He is an award-winning novelist and responsible for a brand new novel called Paradise Valley, which follows on the heels of a really interesting novel, which was actually the first I read by C.J. Box, called Badlands. And this new novel, Paradise Valley, like Badlands, is for the most part set in North Dakota and also in some remote regions of Montana. And it is a part of the country that is important to C.J. Box. As a matter of fact, he makes his home in Wyoming, and so he knows this part of the country well. And obviously had the idea that this would be fertile ground for fiction, and it has certainly proven to be that for him. I loved Badlands, and I love Paradise Valley, and I'm very excited for this opportunity to reconnect with the author, C.J. Box, to talk about Paradise Valley, which is published by Minotaur Books. C.J. Box, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you, and thank you for having me back. I appreciate it.
I'm happy to be speaking with you. Honestly, I don't remember from our first conversation your background as a writer. That is how you first became really seriously interested in writing. Can you recap that for us, please?
Sure. I was a journalist first. Editor of the high school newspaper, and then I got a scholarship to go to University of Denver in journalism. And my first job out of college was on a small weekly newspaper in Wyoming. And then after that, wrote syndicated columns that would feature around Wyoming. So I'd always kind of gone that direction. But it took 20 years once I decided that I wanted to actually write fiction, write a novel before I got published.
One of the things that jumped out at me as I read your bio is that your novels, at least some of them, it says, have been translated into 27 languages. And I was just astounded to read that because somehow these novels are, at least the ones that I've read, Badlands and now Paradise Valley, are so unmistakably American through and through. set in America, and they just feel like American novels, kind of a slice of our own Americana. And it's just really intriguing to me to think about, first of all, such a novel being translated into all these other languages and being read by people far away from the United States with no connection to the United States. Can you just say a word about that, about the connection that evidently your novels have with non-American readers, and what that process is like to translate such works into other languages and to try to retain their original American flavor?
Well, it astounds me as well, to be honest. When I first started writing, I thought if I ever got a book published, I hoped it would be perceived as very authentic within the, you know, within Wyoming and the Rocky Mountain region, never really ever expecting to go nationwide, and much less, you know, like you said, 27 languages. All I can say, you know, I have nothing to do with the translations. I don't know how good they are. Foreign publishers, when they buy the rights, they may change the title, may change the cover. I have no idea what the end result is. And sometimes it's strange to get emails or letters from people around the world. Sometimes I can't even read them to get an idea of what they think about them. I guess all I can say is I think some of the themes are somewhat universal to wherever anybody lives. But the other thing is I think some readers, and I'm one of them, just like to read about a place that you're not familiar with. I like to read novels that are set in all over the world and in sometimes very obscure places, just to get a better sense of that sense of place. And I'm guessing that kind of works in reverse as well.
Sure. Well, and honestly, as someone who lives in southeastern Wisconsin, I have that experience to some extent, at least, as I read your books. And I was born in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, but Sioux Falls, South Dakota is very, very different from some of these remote locales in North Dakota and in some of the even more remote locales of Montana, where this new novel is set. But in many respects, and particularly because you describe these places so well, they feel exotic, even to probably many American readers.
Well, I know that in the new novel, Paradise Valley, I think I'm probably the only person who has ever written extended scenes and set in Ekalaka, Montana. And I've been there. It's not a place that you go through en route to anywhere else. You've got to be going to Ekalaka to get to Ekalaka. But I have been there, and it's kind of fun and interesting to highlight areas that aren't well known, I think, and to try to render them accurately and make them interesting or just unique.
Mm. Could we speak just a moment generally about this part of the country where you now make your home? If I remember correctly, you live right around Cheyenne, sometimes in Cheyenne, sometimes on your ranch close to Cheyenne. So obviously, on a personal level, you love this part of the country. I would really be interested in knowing what you love about it and what you love about it as a backdrop for at least a lot of your fiction.
Well, I love it. I guess I was born in Wyoming, so I'm used to it. But also, I do love, like, the vistas, where you can see sometimes 10, 20 miles if you get high enough in the mountains and not see anything that's not natural. I think it tends to somehow, there's so few people. You know, there's only 600,000 people in the state of Wyoming. There's not that many more in North Dakota or Montana. I think it tends to kind of focus, the people who live there tend to have big personalities, I think, almost like to fill the void, to fill the space. And they choose to live there, and they like to live there, and they come from all kinds of backgrounds, and they're very colorful. And I'm not saying they're more colorful than other parts of the U.S. Maybe they just stand out more because there are so few of them. And I like to get right into the culture and, sociology of the area, as well as the terrain, which is a terrain and weather, which are both really, really important parts of all my books.
I wonder what amount of poetic license was and is required of you to set so much of your fiction in these places where those of us on the outside perceive little or nothing happening that would be sort of standard fodder for an exciting novel. And I suppose to some extent, many novelists have to do that. I mean, they have to insert action into a place where such action is not the normal run-of-the-mill events, noteworthy in some instance. To what extent is that the case here? Or do some of these amazing, dramatic, and violent things that you describe in your novels, do they indeed sometimes take place in these incredibly remote places where we can scarcely imagine such a thing happening?
Well, I think the answer to that is kind of both. There are incidents that happen, stories that I hear in real life, that if I, I often fictionalize some of the real things that have happened, so I have to scale them back as opposed to make them more dramatic, because sometimes they're just too unbelievable that even if they're on the page, I'd have to justify it in a way by saying it really, really happened. It really did. So I kind of scale it back to make it more believable. But at the same time, there is poetic license. And, everybody who reads a book, like these, you know, they want some kind of sense of justice in the end. And sometimes things happen where the perpetrators are never caught. In Paradise Valley, it's about, part of it is about a long-haul trucker who's a serial killer. And they really exist. The FBI created what they called a highway serial killer task force about 8 years ago, because they realized at that time they figured that there was about 1,000 missing truck stop prostitutes across the U.S., and it was probably the work of 20 to 24 drivers. And since then, they've revised those estimates way up into the 2,000 or so. And only one of those drivers has ever been caught. So when I read about that story, it started getting me thinking about all of these big trucks on the highway and in remote locations, and if it's a really bad person behind the wheel, what they can get away with.
Mm. Well, and of course, that kind of story makes perfect sense, and not just in the fertile imagination of a gifted novelist, but it makes sense in the real world. In other words, this is happening, and it's no coincidence that it's happening where it's happening. I mean, that this is, in a sense, a landscape and maybe a culture in which such things are, in a sense, almost more likely to occur because of certain factors that make it, unfortunately, all too possible.
Right. I think if you're a bad guy and you're in a very remote location, I think it makes sense that you might think you can get away with things that you can't in other places, and that sometimes happens too. And plus, remote areas are great dumping grounds if you're a bad guy.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with best-selling novelist C.J. Box about his latest novel called Paradise Valley, which follows on the heels of a very fine novel called Badlands. And C.J. Box, explain the central character of these two novels, Cassie Duell, and maybe make brief mention of the first time she appeared in one of your novels, which was actually ahead of Badlands.
Right. I do talk a lot about, I'm on the book tour right now, the fact that I never intended to write an additional series to the Joe Pickett series, but Cassie Duell was introduced in the book called The Highway, and 6 years ago, which is also where the serial killer truck driver, the Lizard King, was introduced. And in effect, she kind of took over the novel about halfway through, not really my intention, but I really enjoyed writing about this character who's a single mom. Her husband died in Afghanistan. She's got a son, and she's a very dogged investigator. And in Badlands, the last book, she was hired to work for the in North Dakota in the middle of the oil boom there in the Bakken fields. And so she's a very much a fish out of water in that area where, you know, it's 20 to 1 men to women. And although that book kind of stands alone in a sense, she's still pursuing the Lizard King. And in this book, Paradise Valley, they're on a collision course. And she figures out where he might be. And that's the impetus of the book. And kind of it's kind of a road novel in a way as she hones in on him.
Describe the way you constructed her as a character, because it seems to me that one of the neatest things about her is that she is committed to her job, gifted for it in some respects, and yet by no means perfect at what she does. I mean, she's someone who makes some mistakes and in this most recent novel makes a terribly costly mistake. But talk about kind of that mixture and maybe the proportions that you have created in terms of those characteristics, because it seems to me that altering the proportions of what I've just described could make a really big difference in terms of what we think about this character.
Right. Thank you. Yeah, she's no super cop. She's not the type of character who walks into a room and, you know, takes them all on and beats them all up. She's not really very physically strong, and probably the one thing about her is just that she's almost obsessed with finding this bad guy. And she makes a horrendous mistake in the beginning of the book with trying to entrap the serial killer who outsmarts her, and it comes with a horrific result. She loses her future husband and other members of the police force, and then she's on her own. And she kind of, you know, even though, you know, she's been had this horrible setback, she can't let it go, so she just keeps going after him. And so I think that says a lot about her character, because there's no reason for her to do that. She's not getting paid for it anymore. But I think it makes her very real and very vulnerable, and I hope really interesting.
Right, absolutely. And she is living at this time in a part of North Dakota that has been part of a boom and now, in a sense, is part of a bust. Describe the real-life scenario that a lot of us have at least heard a little bit about in terms of the state of North Dakota, and then specifically how you painted that picture in this particular community.
Thank you. Yeah, I was fascinated with that. I mean, imagine a place that is losing population in every single census, and the only people that are kind of left in this really remote area are old farmers from Scandinavia, and then suddenly the technology for fracking is improved, and this very remote area is suddenly producing 20% of the nation's oil, and what kind of change that could be in a very remote area. And I was fascinated with that whole thing. I went up, I was in Williston, North Dakota for about a week, riding around with the local sheriff at the height of the boom. And it was unbelievable, kind of a new Wild West and atmosphere. And I wanted to set a book there. That was Badlands. But since then, that was just, 2 years ago. But since then, you know, the price of oil has gone down. The boom is still, they're still producing the oil, but it's not as crazy as it was. And I wanted to reflect that in this book, that the circumstances had changed.
Well, and so, for instance, we have Cassie Duell, I think, living in a cul-de-sac where most of the houses are unoccupied. And everywhere you look in this town, there seem to be sort of monuments to premature building and outsized dreams that are not, in fact, being fulfilled. It's a really, really interesting scenario to think about, and very, very sobering, particularly when one realizes that this is something you're not just making up because it makes the novel interesting, but you're in fact reflecting what has to be a very bewildering reality for a lot of people in North Dakota right now.
That's right. Like in the city of Williston, which is my, I called it Grimstad in the novel, but everybody knows where it is. At the time of the boom, there was not enough housing by a long shot. There were man camps set up outside of town and so on. So they immediately began as much construction as possible. And by the time the construction was done, the boom was over, and there was nobody to move into those houses. So now it's almost like a modern-day ghost town in some areas, subdivisions where there's just one or two houses that are occupied. So it's kind of creepy and kind of eerie.
Mm. We certainly don't want to give away what happens towards the front of this new novel, Paradise Valley, what goes so drastically wrong. But suffice to say that something goes really badly wrong just when Cassie Duell thinks the noose is tightening around the neck of this horrific figure, the serial killer known as the Lizard King. I just want to ask you a couple of questions. She has, in a sense, laid a trap that she thinks is inescapable. And I want you to just say a word about the circumstances within which she sets this trap for this trucker. And it's kind of interesting because in describing this trap and her thinking, we realize that she knows a lot about, and you know a lot about, the real lives of truckers and some of the economic realities with which they contend. And playing off of that, that is what gives her the information to construct this trap for the Lizard King. Describe, first of all, kind of the real-life challenges of these long-distance truckers and how that feeds into the setting of this trap, which ultimately goes awry.
Sure. There's kind of a myth about independent truckers. I think it probably came in around the 70s of lone wolves, cowboys out on the road. There's very, very few of them now in the modern day world. It's a highly regulated industry. There's very few independent truckers, but there are a few. And the way that they make their living is by picking up loads that are posted in truck stops on screens. People list, I have so many skids, I have so many pallets of so-and-so, of something that go to another place. And these truckers then make the deal themselves, not through a trucking company, and pick them up and go. And sometimes they'll take two or three of these kind of loads. And Cassie realizes that the Lizard King is one of the few left independent truckers. So she sets a trap by posting on these boards that she's got a shipment that needs to be delivered. And for 2 years, she's waiting for him to call and say he wants to do it. And they change up the shipment every day, and they try to make it anonymous so he can't figure it out. But when he finally bites and makes the call and says he's coming, she knows that he in fact is going to come right to her town where she can get him. But then things go wrong.
Right. Another factor that she thinks is in her favor in terms of this plan going well is the fact that the Lizard King, this serial killer who's also a long-distance truck driver, plays by the rules absolutely as a truck driver. I mean, there's this other side of him where he's doing these horrific things, but he follows the rules of trucking to the letter.
Right,
explain, been caught. Right. So explain the kind of rules that we're talking about and why somebody like the Lizard King would be so careful to toe the line and be law-abiding, at least in this limited respect.
Well, part of that is based on fact, and that is that of the killers that are out on the highway that the FBI have determined, only one of them has ever been caught. And he was caught not in the act, but he was caught because a taillight was out. And he was pulled over, and the trooper saw a body inside the cab. And then he confessed to 20 or 30 other killings. So I kind of used that true incident to figure out that if these guys are out there, they're following the rules. They're not doing dumb things. They're not driving too long. They get their mandated federal regulatory rest. They stop at every truck stop because they don't want to be pulled over for something that will lead to their arrest. And so I kind of incorporated that into this character, is that in order to do what he does, he needs to not break any other rules and increase the risk of him being caught.
Explain to our listeners what the Lizard King has been doing, what makes him such a vicious, despicable character.
Well, it in a weird way, it's almost like a perfect crime because, you know, a truck stop prostitute or somebody else who's picked up on the highway, it would be unusual for them to immediately be reported missing because of their lifestyle and the way they are. So by the time someone realizes that a woman is gone, that trucker is probably 12 states away, and they can never link them back to the disappearance. So as long as he keeps on the move all the time, like a shark, it's hard to pin him into any certain area. So that's how he has built his life. So he's always moving. And he's also created, put a kill room inside the back of his trailer that he can take that woman and take her on the road for a few days before he dumps her. So there's never any bodies found. That's the other thing. He's figured out a way to get rid of those.
Mm-hmm. Explain your protagonist, Cassie Duell, her connection to the Lizard King.
Well, in the book The Highway, her boss and mentor is actually killed as a result of the Lizard King. So she's got a personal connection to finding him. But he also gets away. And despite her best efforts, she can't get him. So it's like almost like her life can't really go on until she finally gets this guy. And in the previous book, Badlands, they get him in North Carolina. He's actually arrested, but because of a technicality and because of some mistakes by the prosecutors, he's released. So that just redoubles her obsession.
To bringing him to justice somehow.
Yes.
We're speaking with C.J. Box, and we're talking about his most recent novel, which is called Paradise Valley. It comes on the heels of Badlands. And as we've been discussing, this novel, like Badlands, centers on Cassie Duell and her dogged pursuit of this brutal serial killer known as the Lizard King. And a trap is set close to the beginning of Paradise Valley. That trap goes terribly wrong. And ultimately, Cassie Duell loses her job with the Bakken County Sheriff's Department and has to, in a sense, continue her pursuit as a private investigator. You actually have her in the novel pursuing an entirely different matter, which at a glance might not have any connection whatsoever to do with the Lizard King. I'm just curious what prompted you as the novelist to create this other storyline in which a couple of young men disappear from the community, although at the time of their disappearance it's by no means assumed that they have been kidnapped or killed or anything, but I'm just curious how it made sense for you in the crafting of Paradise Valley to create this sort of offshoot story.
Well, in the book Badlands, an important character in there is a 12-year-old boy named Kyle Westergaard, who has mild fetal alcohol syndrome, and he is key to everything that happens in the book. And in the end, Cassie kind of saves this boy. And in Paradise Valley, Kyle and a friend of his decide to fulfill their lifelong dream and float away on the Missouri River, hopefully all the way to New Orleans. Just kind of a child boyhood fantasy. And they do that at the same time that the trap is being set at another part of town. And unfortunately, they intersect with the Lizard King later on. And Cassie starts to realize or figure out that it all comes together. That one, you know, the storyline of Kyle and the end of the Lizard King is all getting melded into one. That's one thing with Paradise Valley. There's a lot of characters from previous books loosely associated within this series, where a lot of the characters come back, and we see them again. And it's not necessary to have read all of the books to get it, but if someone has, they're going to meet a lot of people, or re-meet a lot of people that they read about earlier.
Right. When she makes her way to this incredibly remote, tiny town of, is it, did you say Ekalaka?
Ekalaka, Montana.
Ekalaka, right. Montana, on State Highway 7. So first of all, there is such a place, right?
There is. I've been there, yeah.
And you describe it so well, we feel like we are there in kind of a creepy sort of way that I think is quite uncommon. And you also describe as Cassie is making her way to this incredibly remote town about the relationship between at least some of the people who live in Montana and some of them who live in North Dakota. Describe that. It's interesting.
I think it's probably every state in the United States, there's always an adjoining state where everybody makes fun of them. And in Montana, they love to make fun of people from North Dakota. And in bars and stuff, there are signs about, you know, the dumb people from North Dakota kind of thing. So there's a weird kind of relationship. In North Dakota, they do that about people from South Dakota. But I know that the Montana thing exists because I've been there and seen and heard them, telling jokes about people from North Dakota and how dumb they might be, even though it's not true. So I know that to be a fact, so I put that in the book.
Right. And I really enjoy this as Cassie Duell makes her way into the town. This is what you write. She almost drove out the other side of Ekalaka before she realized there was no more Ekalaka. Only one short main commercial street and unpaved roads to scattered homes. She did a U-turn and parked on the shoulder of the highway. The tiny community was in an oasis of trees in the high desert landscape. The whole of the town spanned her windshield. So is that literally true? Is that something you remember observing from your visit to Ekalaka?
That's literally true. I remember the first time I went there, I drove through it before I realized that it was done.
She ultimately meets up with, is it the sheriff in Ekalaka?
Correct.
And he turns out to be, at least as far as we can tell, a good man.
Right.
And someone with whom Cassie can work and so he's on the right side here. I'm just curious, you know, first of all, I'm not sure if this is someone who's been a part of any of your previous novels, but I wonder what you think about as the novelist when you decide that when she makes her way to this remote town where a body has been found, should the sheriff there be a good guy who works with her, or in a sense a bad guy with sinister intentions, or maybe just a resistant, uncooperative guy who makes her life difficult? Or I mean, there's just obviously a plethora of endless options. What kinds of things do you think about when you ultimately decide that, for instance, the sheriff in this tiny little town will be an ally to your main character? What goes into a choice like that?
part of it, when I was actually in North Dakota doing the research for Badlands, I was riding along with the local sheriff, who turned out to be a fan. He'd read all my books. I didn't know that going in. And after he showed me everything there was, you know, about the boom town, and as he was dropping me off, he said, "You know, I've read all your books. It'd be really nice if, for once, you know, you had a sheriff in your books who wasn't corrupt." And it really made me think that I had kind of tended to do that through a lot of novels, and that although it creates tension on the page, it's not necessarily accurate that almost every one of them was corrupt. So he really made me think, and I think most law enforcement people are very dedicated, very real, very good. They want to do the right thing, and I wanted to portray that in this book.
I'm really glad you did. I mean, and I think that's a really good point. I can remember speaking, one novelist comes to mind, for instance, where I remember through the course of discussing three different novels he had written, in every single one of them, if there was a figure associated with the church, with organized religion of any kind, they were a bad person with sinister ulterior motives or whatever, or maybe in the thick of the plot as a out and out villain, but without exception. And after a while it became a trope that I really found tiresome and quite predictable. And he actually, by the time we were talking about this the third time, he kind of grudgingly agreed that he was sawing away at something that was some kind of issue for him, but it, as a novelist, it didn't make sense anymore to keep going back to that, what was becoming a very tired device. And in a sense, I mean, I haven't even, you know, read all of your previous novels, but I felt this sense of what a refreshing surprise it was that this older sheriff in this tiny town was not someone who was going to give Cassie trouble, but was going to be open-hearted and generous and try to help her any way he could.
Good, thank you. I do try to play against the stereotypes throughout all of the novels where, not every environmentalist is a good guy, not every developer is a bad guy. I try to play it more down the middle and more realistic, I think, I hope.
Tell us about the construction of this novel and the fact that we are popping back and forth between different locales and occasionally popping back and forth in terms of where we are on the timeline. This does not play out in smooth, unbroken chronology. I think it works great, but I don't even know how you did it. I mean, it seems like constructing a novel like that could lead to something really confusing. Could you just say a word about how challenging it was to construct the novel in this fashion?
It is challenging to do that. I think it's rewarding for a reader if it's done right. But I've done several books where things are happening in real time from different points of view. And it's hard to write, but at the same time, it in effect kind of pulls the reader in because the reader's the only one who knows everything. They know several perspectives. They know several points of view that are going on. And the investigator doesn't. The investigator only knows what the investigator knows. So I think it adds to the tension. And what I usually do is just basically draw out a grid on a piece of paper and on the left side put all of the characters and on the top put the timeline. So I know where everybody is at the same time, and then bounce back and forth. And if as a reader, you don't think about that timeline very much, you just get compelled to keep reading, then it worked.
Wow. I want to also say that, again, without giving too much away, that there are two women who have been kidnapped and held in captivity. And one of the most interesting things about this is that they are very different from one another.
Yes.
And in a sense, not easy, compatible allies at all. And that was an interesting surprise to me. I think if one, for whatever reason, takes the time to imagine a really terrible scenario like this, like two women having been kidnapped against their will and held, that somehow they would immediately be hugging one another and crying in each other's arms and resolutely determined to work together to achieve their freedom. And this is a much more complicated scenario than that. I'm just wondering if that occurred easily or naturally to you to construct this scenario in this particular way.
Well, I just figured that in a scenario like that where they're thrown together and they're such opposites that they'd also think of their own survival, and that in effect, as much as it as distasteful as it is, they kind of want to curry the favor of the kidnapper so that they're not the next one to go, so they're rivals in a sense, and it just seemed to me that would be a kind of a natural reaction, even though it doesn't necessarily serve them well.
Right. One of the really chilling aspects of this kidnapping story is the use of collars. And again, I don't want to give too much away, but probably just those few words, our listeners have some sense of what I'm talking about. But these are collars in which pain can be inflicted, and it is one way in which control is kept over these hostages. Is that just out of your own imagination, trying to imagine a really terrible way this could be carried out, or have there been instances in which something like this has actually been used in real life?
I'm not aware of a real life use of that. You know, I think when you write crime, mystery, thriller kind of novels, you tend to look at everything around you in a different way. You know, it kind of goes back to that saying, you know, if you walk around with a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. Well, if you write these kind of books, I think everything starts to look like a weapon of some kind.
Interesting.
And I'm a bird hunter, and I've trained Labradors using electronic collars, and I just took it from there.
Wow. I wonder, I was kind of surprised as I read Paradise Valley to find myself actually feeling sort of admiration, and I just cringe to even say that out loud, but for the masterful, meticulous work of this terrible villain. I mean, on the one hand, we read what he is doing, and if we could, we would drop him in a vat of boiling acid. But on the other hand, I found myself astounded by his attention to detail, by the focus that he brought to every single task, which helps us understand why he has never been caught. I wonder if anybody else expresses similar feelings, or if even you yourself, as you are constructing this character and laying out what he does, feel that on an at least some kind of subconscious level.
There's a good reason why in real life most of these truckers have never been caught, and that's because they're careful. And after The Highway came out, I was on a fishing trip in Mexico, and it turned out that one of the other fishermen who was there, I didn't know him at the time, was a very well-known forensic pathologist who had interviewed Ted Bundy and other serial killers in real life. And he had just read that book, and he said, "Boy, I don't know who you talked to, but you got this guy exactly right." And it was it was good to hear that, but it was also kind of chilling to hear that he thought I got the mentality of somebody like that so close.
Hmm. Right. And of course, this is someone we hope has no place in our own lives. I mean, we hope we don't know anybody who is doing something so despicable behind closed doors. But
right.
It's an interesting place for a writer to go and for a reader to go. And, of course, hot on his trail is this persistent, relentless investigator named Cassie Duell. And we, of course, cheer her on every step of the way to see if she can ultimately bring the Lizard King to justice. A last question. I was reading in your biography that you have worked as a ranch hand, a surveyor, a fishing guide, a small-town newspaper reporter. You co-owned a tourism marketing firm. And, of course, now part of your time is spent on your own ranch. That's a really interesting array of vocations. And I wonder to what extent that kind of wealth of varied experience has made a difference for the better in terms of the fiction that you create.
No, that's a great question. I have found it to be hugely valuable. I think one of the things that kind of puts me off sometimes, I'm a reader, a voracious reader, when I feel like an author has never really actually been out in the real world. They've spent their whole time in academia or, a creative writing bubble. And, the real world out there, like the world of trucking or other things are not accurately rendered because they don't have a clue about what it's like to really work for a living and do other things. I have done that, not by design, but just by circumstance, and I think it helps. And when I do the research for the novels, I like to talk to people who, are out there doing things like in the oil field, and so I can get that right. I like to read books like that, and that's the kind of books I like to write.
Hmm. I lied. Here's the last question. and I hope this doesn't bother you. I love this book. I would also love to have it transformed into a film. I could really imagine this being a very, very powerful, engrossing film. You as an author in love with the printed page, does that bother you that a reader might feel that hunger about something that you've written? I don't mean to convey that I'm in any way dissatisfied with this book or feel like this is just step one of what its ultimate destiny should be. But nevertheless, I just find myself again and again hoping that I can experience this story again somehow on the screen for some reason. Would that be an opportunity you would welcome? And is it okay if a reader feels that way?
Of course it is. I do point out to people when they ask, about that, that it's not really the ultimate validation of a novel to make it turn into a TV series or a movie. The novel stands on its own. But at the same time, I think if it ever does reach the screen or television, that it might steer more people towards the books. And in fact, this book, Paradise Valley, along with The Highway and Back of Beyond, have been purchased by producer David E. Kelley, who did Big Little Lies and have done a lot of TV shows, to possibly turn it into a TV series. And because he's known for being very accurate and dedicated to the source material, I'm very comfortable with that.
Wow. Well, we'll be interested to see that. But in the meantime, I would encourage anybody to take in hand Paradise Valley. And, of course, it's helpful to read the novel that came before it, Badlands, to really get the full story of Cassie Duell and this despicable villain known as the Lizard King. This new novel again, Paradise Valley, published by Minotaur Books, and the author C.J. Box. C.J. Box, I hope you can tell how much I love this novel, and I'm so appreciative of this opportunity to speak with you. Very best wishes, especially with all of your future writing.
Thank you. Likewise. This was really fun. Thanks for the great questions.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I am going to be offering up an interview that I should be recording later this morning with Wisconsin Public Radio's own Kathleen Dunn, who is about to retire. In fact, her last program is Thursday. And tomorrow you will hear my conversation with her talking about this wonderful thing called radio and about her long, distinguished career with Wisconsin Public Radio. On Thursday, another big interview with Dr. John Swallow, the new president of Carthage College. This will be his first visit, the first of, I hope, many visits to the morning show. And on Friday, Guida Brown, who is the director of the Hope Council on Alcohol and Other Drug Abuse. And we will be talking about various kinds of